Hello, Sun Sounds listeners. This is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. I'm going to read the major news articles from the Monday, September 15th, 2025 edition of Tucson's Arizona Daily Star. And before we begin with the headline articles, let's find out what kind of weather is in store for us. Today's weather, sunshine and a few clouds, a stray shower or thunderstorm is possible. Highs to 99 degrees Fahrenheit, winds southwest at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tonight's forecast, partly cloudy skies, lows to 74 degrees Fahrenheit, winds south-southeast at 5 to 10 miles per hour. Tomorrow's forecast predicts sunny skies during the morning hours will become overcast in the afternoon. A stray shower or thunderstorm is possible. Highs to 98 degrees Fahrenheit, east-southeast winds shifting to northwest at 10 to 15 miles per hour. We'll begin with the reading of the first article in the Arizona Daily Star front page titled, Colleges Split on Clear Policies for Ice on Campus. This article was written by Molly Bohannon of the Arizona Center for Investigative Journalism. In January 2025, Arizona State University junior Brittany Vera scrolled past a social media post she thought seemed too outrageous to be real. A campus club was promoting an event where students could report your illegal classmates to federal immigration authorities. Organized by College Republicans United, the plan prompted Vera and her peers in Aliento at ASU, a group supporting undocumented students and those from mixed-status families, to swiftly coordinate a protest. After members of the club set up a table on campus, hundreds of students marched around them in opposition, with some holding signs that read, Our diversity is our power and let us learn. Vera recalled the moment as a powerful high. Within hours, though, she was deflated when ASU issued a statement defending the club's right to free speech while condemning its message. Now a senior, Vera feels university leadership hasn't said or done much more to ease students' fears about immigration agents entering campus and targeting international and undocumented students. After the Trump administration lifted protections that made schools off-limits to immigration enforcement, education and immigration experts say universities need clear plans for responding to potential on-campus visits from agents to minimize chaos and reassure fearful students. Though the Arizona Center for Investigative Reporting found no documented cases of immigration and customs enforcement appearing on Arizona campuses as of September 7th, agents have shown up near universities in at least two other states so far. Even just the rumor of ICE being on campus can be really terrifying for students and can really prevent them from even going to the institutions. Monica Andrade, Director of State Policy and Legal Strategy for the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration, told AZCIR they might decide not to go to class that day. It's really disruptive. Arizona's two largest public universities, ASU and the University of Arizona, have not issued instructions explicitly addressing what to do if ICE agents arrive. Neither has Central Arizona College, Cochise College, Eastern Arizona College, or Grand Canyon University. AZCIR found after requesting policies or guidance about ICE on campus from the state's 20 higher education institutions with the largest in-person enrollments. Yavapai College, meanwhile, drafted an FAQ that explained students' rights, safety measures, and described how the school would support immigrant students. A spokesman said the school had not shared that information publicly, but did make recommendations for handling ICE visits and other emergency situations available to employees. Maricopa Community Colleges, along with Pima Community College, Arizona Western College, and Northern Arizona University, have furnished more comprehensive information to students, employees, or both about what to do during ICE encounters on campus. In the early months of his second term, President Donald Trump's administration has withheld funding from higher education institutions, detained international students, restricted schools' ability to enroll them, and pressured schools to align with its political agenda. Its crackdown on universities has produced a chilling effect, with colleges first and foremost looking out for their institutional stability. According to Catherine Meyer, the governance fellow at the Brookings Institute Brown Center on Education Policy, there's a widespread concern across universities that they might end up being the target of the next investigation from federal officials. They might be the next target to have funding frozen, she said. Meyer believes the current climate has made schools more hesitant about what they're willing to put in writing when it comes to communicating with campus communities about immigration enforcement and other sensitive issues, she said. Schools may be weighing the pros and cons of federal attention versus potentially alienating students, faculty, and staff. Beyond taking aim at specific university policies, the Trump administration rescinded Department of Homeland Security guidelines shielding schools, churches, and medical or mental health care facilities from enforcement actions. While ICE still cannot conduct warrantless searches in spaces with a constitutionally protected expectation of privacy, such as homes or workplaces, officials can legally make arrests in publicly accessible areas like university courtyards. The administration's actions have heightened anxiety among the state's estimated 11,000 undocumented students and nearly 28,000 international students in higher education. Advocates are also on high alert, particularly as the administration dedicates more resources to immigration enforcement, including funding to hire 10,000 or more ICE agents. Our belief is that they are ramping this up, said ACLU of Arizona Board of Policy strategist Noah Schramm, pointing to huge investments in ICE staffing and detention capacity. It's sort of like that's the writing on the wall. Experts told AZCIR that because ICE's authority varies by location, campus staff and students need to understand which spaces are public versus private and know their rights if officials arrive. ICE doesn't have unlimited discretion to operate in these areas, and if there's a lack of clarity on policy and what to do in certain situations, universities may be giving ICE rights that it doesn't have to give them, Schramm said. ASU and UA offered scant information about their decisions not to implement new policies or guidance addressing immigration enforcement on campus. ASU, which has about 78,000 students on campus, has not fulfilled a July 23rd public records request seeking copies of such communications. Asked if any guidance had been shared with students or staff, Media Relations Director Veronica Sanchez said no agents had been on campus and that if they were to visit, we would expect them to connect in advance with ASU police. Sanchez repeatedly sidestepped questions about whether the school had an ICE-specific policy and if students, faculty, and staff had been informed of one, saying that the university would work with ICE in the same way we would work with any law enforcement personnel that came in onto our campuses. Vera said the school's handling of AZCIR's inquiries made her anxious to return to ASU this fall. As a member of a mixed-status family, she'd hoped university leadership would at least give a simple acknowledgement that they're aware of what's going on. It kind of just feels like, oh, we had a break, a little 3 months break, but now we're back to the reality of our education being able to be taken away, she said. Emilio Sotelo Estrada, another ASU senior who has worked with undocumented classmates through Aliento, told AZCIR that she recognizes her university is in a difficult position with the current administration, but she worries about the many gray areas where students and faculty don't know what law enforcement can and cannot do. Students and staff need to be prepared in order to protect everyone's safety, Sotelo Estrada said, including that of any immigration officers who may show up on campus. United Campus Workers of Arizona, which represents staff at the state's three largest public universities, called on UA and ASU leaders to do more and say more against these federal attacks on students. One of their main duties, UCW Arizona Acting President Marcos Esparza said, should be ensuring students can work and study without feeling they're going to be deported or have to leave the country immediately. UA, which has nearly 42,000 students in Tucson, told AZCIR it did not possess any responsive records regarding policies for handling immigration officials on campus. When asked about the lack of direction, university spokesperson Mitch Zack pointed to 2019 guidance on interacting with non-university law enforcement. Zack insisted that guidance was clear, applied to federal immigration officials, and was designed to ensure that faculty and staff were aware, prepared, and supported should they encounter such situations. Yet it makes no explicit mention of immigration authorities, and Zack acknowledged it is not specific to any agency. The information posted on the UA webpage on the federal landscape directs employees to cooperate with officers, notify UA police, and not physically block or interfere with officers' entry or actions. Ben Armentrout, a graduate student and former president of UA's College Democrats, helped launch a petition in February urging the university to formally reject cooperation with federal immigration enforcement unless required by a warrant. It also implored leaders to prepare faculty and staff for possible ICE encounters on campus and to publicly affirm their commitment to a safe learning environment for all students, regardless of immigration status. It just seems like there's a lot the university can do to make sure its students are safe and have the ability to learn that it hasn't done yet, Armentrout told AZCIR. UA sophomore Cynthia Moran, who comes from a mixed-status family, similarly urged that the university is not taking the correct measures and ensuring the safety of students, particularly those without legal status. It's not fair for them. My peers who walk the same hallways I walk or sit in the same stairs and tables I sit at, for them to be living with that fear when they're not doing anything more than getting an education, which is so harmless, Moran said. Layla Hudson, a global studies professor and elected faculty chair at UA, described the school's non-campus law enforcement policy as vague, but said she understands university leadership keeping quiet if the discretion and silence is providing an opportunity for them to have robust plans in place behind the scenes. If that's not the case, she believes the rest of the campus will rise to the occasion of pooling its own knowledge, protecting community members, and not being silent about abuses. I hope that every university administration everywhere rises to meet standards set by our campus communities and are not silently abdicating those responsibilities, she said. Arizona schools that did offer clear instructions and reassurance to their students acted quickly. On January 28th, Pima County College Chancellor Jeffrey Nass released a statement acknowledging the fear and uncertainty prompted by federal immigration changes and affirming the school's commitment to supporting its roughly 17,000 students. Faculty and staff received a written FAQ with guidelines regarding law enforcement inquiries, employee and students' rights, recent executive orders, and federal compliance issues. It advised staff to call campus police and move away from the area if ICE agents arrived, supplying a script for urgent, emergent situations. Students got a similar document laying out their rights, sharing resources for international and refugee students, and explaining immigration policy changes and student protections. It explicitly tackled concerns about whether attending class could expose students to ICE tracking or targeting. Other schools rolled out comparable resources. Northern Arizona University, for instance, circulated FAQs on March 4th to student affairs leadership, emphasizing the school's commitment to students and detailing how faculty and staff should respond to federal immigration officials. Leadership could then share the information with staff who work with students in housing, counseling services, mentoring, academic support, and more. Arizona Wesleyan College hosted a town hall for employees to answer questions and address immigration-related executive orders. Speakers also outlined emergency protocols, reminding attendees that ICE cannot enter private areas without a judicial order. Zarina Gallegos, a senior vice president, said the event sought to raise awareness of legal rights and reduce confusion while supporting all students equally. Reference materials were later provided to employees. Employees at the Maricopa County Community College District's 10 schools, Chandler Gilbert, Estrella Martin, Gateway, Glendale, Mesa, Paradise Valley, Phoenix, Rio Salado, Scottsdale, and South Mountain Community College, received guidance in February on how to handle immigration-related matters on district property, according to district spokesperson Lindsay Wilson. The district, which serves about 140,000 students, explained that federal agents may enter public areas without authorizations but need a judicial warrant or district approval to access places such as classrooms or ID-restricted spaces. The district advised any employee who sees or interacts with an immigration officer to alert their college's designated point of contact and inform the federal agent. You are required to consult with an administration before allowing them access. Those campus contacts were trained in February on their responsibilities when dealing with immigration agents, primarily notifying the police commander and Office of General Counsel. The training also covered the rescinded DHS guidance and the difference between public and private spaces. District officials declined an interview to discuss protocols, but said in a written statement that the point of contact system was meant to ensure a streamlined, consistent response if federal immigration agents appear on campus. Stacy Smith, a professor of business law at Paradise Valley Community College and president of the Maricopa County College Faculty Association, said the clarity provided by leadership allowed professors to focus on supporting their students. I know about what to do, who to call, the steps to take, and I think that is what set up people to feel like they could focus on the classroom, Smith said. We didn't have to worry about, if someone comes to our hallway, what do we do? The next front page article is titled, Governor States Kirk Suspect Uncooperative. This article was written by Nicholas Riccardi and Josh Boak of the Associated Press, Stateline, Washington. Utah Governor Spencer Cox said Sunday that investigators are not ready to discuss the motive behind the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk. Still, he said the suspect had left-leaning political beliefs, disliked the conservative influencer, and is being uncooperative in custody. Clearly a leftist ideology, Cox told NBC's Meet the Press on CNN's State of the Union, he said. That information comes from the people around him, his family members, and friends. Cox said Tyler Robinson, 22, is not cooperating, and friends paint a picture of someone radicalized in the dark corners of the internet. Clearly, there was a lot of gaming going on, Cox said on NBC. Friends have confirmed that there was a kind of that deep dark internet, the Reddit culture, and these other dark places on the internet. Where this person was going deep. A Republican who's called on all partisans to tone down the rhetoric following the attack, the governor added, I really don't have a dog in this fight. If this was a radicalized MAGA person, I'd be saying that as well. Cox stressed on several Sunday morning news shows, however, that investigators are still trying to pin down a motive for the attack on the father of two and confidant of President Donald Trump. Kirk was killed Wednesday at Utah Valley University while on one of his signature college speaking tours. The governor said more information may come out once Robinson appears in court Tuesday. The governor said the suspect's partner was transgender, which some politicians pointed to as a sign Robinson targeted Kirk for his anti-trans views. But authorities have not said whether it is relevant as they investigate Robinson's motive. The roommate was a romantic partner, a male transitioning to female, Cox said. I can say that he has been incredibly cooperative. This partner has been very cooperative, had no idea that this was happening. Blame game after acts of political violence can lead to further attacks. Experts warned investigators spoke to Robinson's relatives and carried out a search warrant at his family's home in Washington, about 240 miles southwest of Utah Valley University, where the shooting took place. State records show Robinson was registered to vote, but not affiliated with a political party, and is listed as inactive, meaning he did not vote in the two most recent general elections. His parents are registered Republicans. Ammunition found with the weapon used to kill Kirk was engraved with a taunting, anti-fascist, and meme-cultured messages. Court records show one bullet casing had the message, "Hey, fascist, catch." Robinson grew up around St. George in the southwestern corner of Utah, between Las Vegas and natural landmarks including Bryce Canyon and Zion National Parks. Robinson became a member of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, known widely as the Mormon Church, at a young age, church spokesperson Doug Anderson said. Robinson has two younger brothers, and his parents have been married for about 25 years, according to social media posts. Online activity by Robinson's mother reflects an active family that took vacations to Disneyland, Hawaii, the Caribbean, and Alaska. Like many in that part of Utah, they frequently spent time outdoors, boating, fishing, riding ATVs, ziplining, and target shooting. A 2017 post shows the family visiting a military facility and posing with assault rifles. A young Robinson is seen smiling as he grips the handles of a 50 caliber heavy machine gun. A high school honor roll who scored in the 99th percentile nationally on standardized tests, he was admitted to Utah State University in 2021 on a prestigious academic scholarship, according to a video of him reading his acceptance letter that was posted to a family member's social media account. But he attended for only one semester, according to the university. He is currently enrolled as a third-year student in the electrical apprenticeship program at Dixie Technical College in St. George. Meanwhile, Kirk was memorialized with candlelit vigils and other events Sunday. At Dream City Church in Phoenix, where Kirk hosted one of his Freedom Nights in America gatherings, attendees viewed clips of the conservative activist discussing his desire to be remembered for courage of my faith. During a question and answer session, a church pastor, Angel Barnett, called on the crowd to honor Kirk by carrying on his message. "The left is nervous," Barnett said, "and they're concerned because they've lost control. Charlie started that, and we will continue it. These cowards thought they could end or eliminate the movement," church panelist Brandon Tatum added. "They just made it bigger. They just made it stronger." The next front page item is titled, "Court Urged to Control Prison Health." This article was written by Bob Christie of Capital Media Services, Dateline Phoenix. More than 3 years after a federal judge found that Arizona's prison healthcare system was plainly grossly inadequate, and 2 years after an injunction required vast improvement, so little progress has been made that lawyers for prisoners now want the judge to essentially take over the system. But attorneys for the state are pleading with senior U.S. District Judge Rosalind Silver to give them more time to improve care. Appointing a receiver to run health care for more than 35,000 inmates would be a last resort and not the quick fix everyone would like to see, they argued at a hearing last week. "There's been progress improving care, although it is slow," said Mary O'Grady, a private attorney representing the Arizona Department of Corrections, Rehabilitation and Reentry, or ADCCR. "From day one, they have been working to comply with this order," O'Grady told Silver of the department's efforts. "So there's a way to go, but when you're looking at progress, there has been concrete progress in terms of the number of healthcare providers in the system now versus where we were in 2022. And O'Grady said appointing a receiver to take over administration of prison healthcare would actually slow progress and siphon cash out of a system that should instead be used to provide patient care. And she pointed to California, where a federal judge appointed a receiver nearly 20 years ago that still oversees that state's prison health care. They're expensive, and it's costs that don't go where that we need them in Arizona, which is on the ground benefiting healthcare, O'Grady said. So they're not costs that move us forward. They're another layer away from direct service. Although Silver issued the current injunction requiring vast improvements in care for inmates in 2023, the case has been ongoing since 2012. That's when Arizona was sued for what attorneys from the American Civil Liberties Union, the Prison Law Office, and other prisoners' rights groups called grossly inadequate care that harmed or even killed inmates. The state agreed to a settlement in 2014, but federal judges overseeing the case ruled repeatedly in the following years that mental and physical health care provided to prisoners failed to live up to basic constitutional standards. They twice found the estate in contempt and issued multi-million dollar fines. In 2021, Silver threw out that settlement because of the ACDCCR's perversive material breaches of the agreement. And during a 15-day trial before Silver in late 2021, attorneys for prisoners presented evidence of repeated and horrific consequences inmates suffered due to poor or inadequate health care. The judge issued a sweeping 200-page ruling in 2022, finding that the state's officials were acting with deliberate indifference to the substantial risk of harm to inmates. In 2023, she issued a comprehensive injunction laying out what the prison system must do to improve that care. That injunction required the state to overhaul how it provided care to inmates, vastly increase the number of doctors and nurses to set levels, and provide better access to specialists. Other parts of the injunction included limits on putting inmates in isolation and requirements to treat opioid addiction and hepatitis infections among the inmate population. The state has increased spending on healthcare and boosted staffing. When the injunction was issued, it was spending about $300 million a year on healthcare and had about 1,100 providers under contract. The most recent Corrections Department report from last month shows about $400 million in yearly spending and more than 1,600 providers under contract. However, only 1,365 or 84% of those positions were filled. AnafCare, a company that won a 5-year contract to oversee prison healthcare in May 2022, has been without a state medical director for a year. More than 2 years after Silver issued the injunction, reports by court-appointed monitors show the state has made little progress. In brief, ADCRR is compliant with some of the requirements of the injunction, but remains non-compliant with the vast majority, with slow or little progress toward achieving substantial compliance, the monitor wrote in a July 16th report. That shows the state lacks the capacity or the will to fix the prison healthcare system, and it's time for Silver to appoint a receiver to do the job. Sophie Hart, an attorney for the Prison Law Office, told the judge during Wednesday's hearing, "We are asking this court to appoint a receiver because after more than a decade of litigation, people incarcerated in the Arizona state prisons remain at unreasonable risk of harm, including death due to a fundamental lack of medical and mental health care," she told Silver. The monitor's recent report is devastating. It details the many system-level failures that continue to cause harm on a daily basis to our clients. Hart said nurses are still providing care a doctor should be providing. And despite the state saying its healthcare contract has hired more, they're still at least 600 short of a staffing plan, what a staffing plan calls for. Defendants tout the recent increases in doctors, but the monitor's report makes clear that the care is still being provided by nurses despite those increases, she told Silver. They cite increases in access to specialty care, but their own data demonstrates that compliance remains very, very poor. The state's process for reviewing death is still failing to identify cases where better care could have prevented those deaths, she said. And she ticked off several other areas where the Corrections Department was failing. Silver herself filed a document in the case docket laying out more than 36 lawsuits filed by prisoners since she issued the injunction in 2023, alleging inadequate or grossly incompetent care. She said she considered them while deciding whether a receiver should be appointed. The basics of the cases are shocking in some cases. One prisoner whose case is still awaiting trial cited deliberate indifference that led to a leg amputation. Another said he lost a testicle because doctors failed to diagnose or treat his complaint of pain for 2 months. The state settled that case. Silver agreed that there's no fast repair for the state's poor prison health care, but she plainly wants action. I think everybody who's involved here knows that you can't have a quick fix in the prison setting, Silver said. And I'm quite aware that this is going to take a lot of care and a lot of resources, she told Grady. But I've given you guidance, and after 2 years, you still don't have all the people who were supposed to be hired according to the contract. That's a concern. It was unclear whether Silver intends to rule on the request to appoint a receiver, and she mixed signals on her thinking. At one point in the hearing, she told O'Grady not to worry about what I'm going to do yet, but I'm going to be very interested in what you have to say to avoid a receivership. Still, she told O'Grady to come up with a plan to kickstart improvements in the system. What are you going to do? How are you trying to get it done? The judge said. What would the department agree to do in order to avoid a receiver and in order, obviously, to comply with the injunction? But she left open the possibility that she'll put a receiver in place to take over health care for inmates. I will do some rather substantial consideration of everything that you've said. I'll talk to our monitors and I'll issue an order, Silver said. The next front page article is titled, Machine Could Be Southern California's Next Wildfire Weapon. This article was written by Noah Haggerty of the Los Angeles Times, Dateline Los Angeles. The giant remote-controlled vehicle, somewhere between a tractor trailer, a tank, and a Zamboni in appearance, slowly rolled across the dry, brittle grass growing between the tangle of freeways, making up the 101 and 23 interchange in Thousand Oaks. Inside the beast, fire churned, and as it rolled over the land, that fire incinerated any brush it encountered, leaving only a thin smoke cloud billowing from top of the machine, some flashes of orange and red from behind its metal skirt, and in its wake, a desolate, smoldering black line. Burnbot isn't the fastest way to rid a landscape of dangerously flammable vegetation. It tops out at around 0.5 miles per hour, but it can do something that traditional vegetation management techniques cannot. With almost surgical precision, it can kill the flammable brush sitting within feet of homes and highways on even the hottest and driest days, and with virtually no safety risks or disruptions to daily life. On a recent summer afternoon, as wildland firefighters maneuvered the machine and mopped up the charred earth on a stretch of highway about 300 miles west of Los Angeles on the 101, a who's who of Southern California's wildfire leadership looked on. And from the California Department of Forestry and Fire Protection, local fire departments, Caltrans, the U.S. Forest and Park Services, Southern California Edison, and the state legislature, the sweet, smoky smell of wildland fire permeated the hot midair. The onlookers quietly took notes. We have to do everything we can to try to figure out ways to lower our wildlife risk in a psychologically friendly way. Physiological friendly way. We don't want to just turn this beautiful environment into concrete, said Senator Benjamin Allen, Democrat of Santa Monica, told the crowd while standing atop Burnbot's metal skirt. We're looking for innovative solutions, and I'm just glad to see this kind of work. As humans ignite fires with increasing frequency in Southern California and continue to build deeper into fire-prone areas, wildfire policymakers and scientists are racing to better understand how to manage the crisis. Private investigators are throwing millions of dollars at the problem, and consequently a slew of entrepreneurs and former firefighters are trying their hand at developing high-tech solutions. Few of the emerging technologies, including BurnBot, have faced rigorous scientific scrutiny yet. Firefighters in Southern California still haven't collected enough data to settle on which broad strategies are most effective, let alone which companies are best at carrying them out. Nevertheless, BurnBot has caught the eyes of the departments and organizations spearheading wildfire mitigation in California. We're always looking at what new technologies there might be that we can utilize to enhance our vegetation management program, said Andrew Dowd, public information officer with the Ventura County Fire Department, which sent a small crew to check out the bot. BurnBot is the brainchild of computer scientist Anucal Lakina, a physicist and physicist Waleed Haddad. After the 2020 Northern California fires, the two put their heads together to develop a technology solutions for the state's crisis. They settled on essentially a Roomba for the forest, as one onlooker at the August demonstration put it. Haddad built a prototype of BurnBot in the kitchen of Lakina's San Francisco home to convince fire scientists and investigators that the idea might actually work. Its first meal, Lakina's backyard. Today, the company has built 5 full-size BurnBots called the RX, shorthand for prescribed and prescribed burn. While the tech was developed and primarily tested in Northern California, Lakina thinks it can help Southern California address 2 unique wildfire risk reduction goals: lower the number of ignitions and create strategic fuel breaks to slow fire and give firefighters access to the region's fire-prone wildlands. BurnBot hopes to thwart human-started fires by removing flammable grasses along common ignition points like roadways and power lines. Vehicles and electrical equipment have historically caused roughly 2% of the fires in the region. Arson, unsupervised kids, and various agriculture, construction, and landscaping equipment have been responsible for the lion's share. However, even those are much more common along roadways and near developments where BurnBot hopes to operate. Currently, agencies such as Caltrans often rely on routine mowing to fight the flammable grasses along transportation corridors and in populated areas. But mowing doesn't completely destroy the grasses, it just gives them a haircut. Their seeds lay hidden underground and the grasses grow back quickly. Herbicides, another common technique for managing invasive grasses, are often expensive to purchase and can leave toxic chemicals in the environment after the treatment. Meanwhile, prescribed burns can cover a lot of ground and, if they burn hot enough, can destroy invasive seeds. But traditional prescribed burns can require road closures for safety reasons, and fire crews typically only perform them in cooler weather conditions to limit the risk of a powerful runaway fire. BurnBot RX, however, can safely run any day, Lakina said. Its most recent demo was August 27th during peak fire season in sweltering 90-degree weather. The only traffic control was a few cones placed along the highway's shoulder, no road closures, no blocked lanes creating congestion. The bot's handlers can also finally control the heat of the burn, ensuring the seeds of invasive plants hiding in the soil get scorched too. While the research evaluating BurnBot's success is limited right now, Lakina said his company is working with Stanford researchers to evaluate how land recovers after a visit from BurnBot. So far, they've seen anecdotal evidence that after a burn, fire-resilient native species often return instead of invasive grasses. The company plans to keep its 5 currently functioning BurnBot RXs in the family, where their experienced technicians and wildland firefighters will use them to complete wildfire risk reduction work across the state. In the coming years, they plan to aggressively grow the size of their operation. Lakina said the company plans to build 15 next year and 50 the year after. Unlike other kinds of disasters, we have a lot of agency here. Take out the fuels, reduce the risk, Lakina said. California has wildfires, but California also has innovators. Shame on us if we can't sort our way out of this. Now we'll pause the broadcast reading for a reminder that you are listening to a broadcast reading of the Arizona Daily Star from Sun Sounds of Arizona. My name is Michael Shannon, and I'm a volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss any part of this program, you can access it on demand anytime on our website, www.sunsounds.org, from the broadcast info and audio link. Sun Sounds is also available on your smart home device. Now we'll turn the page to the Tucson and region section of the Arizona Daily Star for several important and informative articles there. The first item is titled, UA creates a $415,000 post, names former provost finalist. This article was written by Piranha Sanapanavar of the Arizona Daily Star. The University of Arizona has named a former provost candidate from Purdue University as senior vice provost, a new position directly reporting to Provost Patricia Prelock. Jenna Rickus, most recently the senior vice provost for teaching and learning at Purdue, visited the UA campus in March as part of the provost search, a position that was ultimately filled by Prelock on May 19th. Rickus will join the UA on September 29th for the annual compensation of $415,000. The senior vice provost position was created to help coordination and collaboration of initiatives between numerous units, including academic affairs, campus community connections, faculty affairs, university analytics, and institutional research, and the University Center for Assessment, Teaching, and Technology, Prelock announced Thursday. Rickus, a bioengineer and interdisciplinary scholar specializing and biofunctional materials and biosensors, will also be a full-tenured professor of biomedical engineering in UA's College of Engineering. Prelock said Rickus's work addresses critical challenges including brain cancer, diabetes, foodborne illness, and space biology, and she has received more than $120 million in funded grants throughout her career. The campus community met Dr. Rickus last spring during the interviews and an open forum as part of the provost search process, where she emerged as a strong candidate for the position. Prelock wrote in her announcement, Dr. Rickus will bring a collaborative leadership style and deep interdisciplinary expertise to our leadership team. In her role, she will provide strategic guidance, foster stronger communication pathways, and champion innovation initiatives. In her open forum during the UA provost search, Rickus had emphasized the importance of supporting international students in the current political climate and said one-on-one student support in cases of run-ins with immigration officials and others is critical to creating a safe space. Rickus had said that offering her guidance and communication to faculty, advisors, coaches, and staff is important so they have the right knowledge and information to assist international students and their complicated situations. She said a communication plan is needed that includes not just a general email blast that goes out once in a while, but communications of information through the vice provost and college deans. In April, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security under the Trump administration revoked the visas of thousands of international students, making them vulnerable to detention, deportation, and arrest. Additionally, since then, immigration policies have also been tightened for international students from certain countries. Rickus also discussed her excitement about coming to the Hispanic-serving institution like the UA, a federal designation for not-for-profit institutions of higher learning with undergraduate students enrollment that's at least 25% Hispanic. On September 10th, the U.S. Education Department announced plans to end discretionary grant programs for a number of minority-serving institutions, asserting such programs amount to discriminations and are unconstitutional because they require colleges to enroll a certain percentage of students from a particular racial or ethnic background to qualify. To further our commitment to ending discrimination in all forms across federally supported programs, the department will no longer award minority-serving institution grants that discriminate by restricting eligibility to institutions that meet government-mandated racial quotas, said the U.S. Secretary of Education Linda McMahon in the announcement. The next item is titled, How UA is Dividing Pay Raises Sparks Faculty Debate. This article was written by Purana Sanapanavar of the Arizona Daily Star. University of Arizona unit leaders had broad discretion of deciding how to divvy up pay raises that faculty and staff will receive in the first week of October, Chief Financial Officer John Arnold told faculty senators. Some responded with disappointment that it isn't simply an across-the-board raise for all. We implemented a salary increase program. We established a pot of dollars for staff and a pot of dollars for faculty, CFO John Arnold explained Monday, September 8th, at the first Faculty Senate meeting of the new academic year. Those salary increases will take effect the first week of October. We gave broad discretion to unit leaders on how to allocate those dollars. Once the salary increases were determined in each unit, unit leaders were asked to submit the finalized distributions. Arnold said he hadn't seen all the distributions yet, as some units were still finalizing their decisions. As we work through fiscal 27 budget, I know it's a priority for UA President Suresh Garamela to continue to work on salaries, so we'll look at that again for next year, Arnold said. UA officials announced in late February that they would increase the university's minimum wage from $15 to $16.50 and offer raises for most employees starting in October. They said the raises would be given from a pool equaling 2.75% of eligible staff salaries and 2.25% of eligible faculty salaries in each college and division. Additionally, they said senior officials who make more than $250,000 annually would be exempt from the raises. At the Faculty Senate meeting, Arnold explained that central administration established certain rules with unit leaders for the salary increases, saying there had to be merit component to raises, and they did not allow for across-the-board increases. However, most of the unit has kept a portion of the raises across the board and then gave a merit-based raise on top of that, he said. The College of Agriculture, Life, and Veterinary Sciences, for instance, sent out a notice saying it will give across-the-board raises of 1% for faculty and 1.25% for staff, and merit-based raises of 1.25% for faculty and 1.50% for staff. The College of Nursing, on the other hand, is only giving out salary increases based on performance evaluations conducted through the 2025 annual review cycle. Eligible faculty will get a 2.5% or 2.25% percent raise, depending on their rating in that review. As for UA's Arizona Institute for Resilience, all staff and faculties are receiving across-the-board raises of 1.375% and 1.125%, and the remaining 1.375% salary pool for staff and 1.125% salary pool for faculty will be applied as merit increases at the discretion of AIR leadership. While acknowledging the salary increases were positive news since many people at the UA hadn't gotten one in years, Secretary of the Faculty Katie Zaidis said, despite that, and despite this year's erasure of the university's budget deficit, there are faculty in each college still dealing with frozen funds and not being able to spend internal money. So it has come at a cost and continues to be, Zaidis told Arnold, to which he nodded in acknowledgement. Gary Mella, who started at the university about a year ago, pledged to end the university's budget deficit, originally estimated at $240 million in 2023, in the fiscal year that ended July 1st, and he and Arnold succeeded in doing so. The UA's former financial crisis, revealed by then-President Robert C. Robbins in November 2023, eventually resulted in budget cuts and 328 layoffs, including the elimination of 13 vice president posts, according to previous reports. While dealing with the financial challenges, Arnold has said Gary Miller directed that raises be provided starting October 1st as an overdue investment in the UA's workforce. At the meeting, Zaida said two issues had come up in the process of carrying out the salary increase program this year. One was that this time faculty promoted in the last year were exempted from receiving raises, she said, asking why that decision was made. To this, Arnold said central administration allocated one part of money for the salary increases and another part for promotions. Consequently, anyone who received a raise through a promotion was left out of the salary increase program. Second issue Zaida's addressed was that decisions about the raises were made over the summer, and that put the department heads and deans in a difficult position, giving them very little time to finalize the distributions. Some of the salary increase distribution plans were accepted as late as mid-August, and then they had 2 weeks to determine who got a merit raise, and that's a lot of pressure on directors, deans to have a fair process and a transparent process, said Ziders. So part of my question is, how are we going to do this different next year? What did you identify as the challenges and the missteps, and how can we make this rollout a bit more smooth for administrators and then the transparency around it? In response, Arnold started out by acknowledging that there was quite a bit of confusion around the salary increases and what faculty and staff can expect to get. This led to some back and forth between his office and Provost Patricia Prelock's office, she said. Also adding there were delays due to conflicting guidance that went out from his office, the Provost office, and human resources. One thing I've learned since I've been here is you can never communicate enough. There's no such thing as overcommunication, Arnold said. I thought we had explained adequately, but we had not. And so, if and when we do this again, we will make sure we have better written guidelines that go out over and over. UE Chair of the Faculty Layla Hudson said the communication about the salary increases was about as clear as mud. She said she didn't know anyone who knew the kind of raise they will be getting in October, and the only certain thing was that newly promoted faculty like herself won't be getting a raise. But the methodologies used by particular colleges, the amount of raise that any particular faculty member may receive, I think is largely unknown to anyone at this point, Hudson told the Arizona Daily Star. I can also say that when I first heard about the salary increases program back in spring, of course, I was pleased and excited because I, like so many, misunderstood and thought when it was first announced that everyone would be getting a well-deserved and long overdue pay increase, a little bit of over 2%, she continued. As time went on, we learned that no, this was the amount of total payroll that would be dedicated to future pay increases, and that the methodologies would be decided by individual college deans without much transparency, and there was a good chance that some people might not receive anything. Most people would receive much less than 2%. Jeff Mitchler, a UA Associate Professor of Agriculture Resource Economics, echoed Hudson's comments by saying he knew many people who were expecting a 2.75% or 2.25% increase in their salary. The administration did not do a good job of communicating the nuance that only some but not all eligible faculty and staff would get the announced 2.75 or 2.25% increase, he told the Star Friday. At the meeting, Faculty Senator Ted Downing and Research Professor of Social Development raised a question to Arnold of how central administration justifies the outrageously large salaries of top-level administrators when university-wide faculty and staff were getting about 1% cost of living raise. Budgets show priorities, said Downing, quoting Arnold from a previous Faculty Senate meeting in the spring. What is a priority that explains these huge, huge salaries? To this, Arnold didn't say much besides stating that generally the salaries are set on the basis of a number of factors, including market and performance. Downing responded by saying there was a market for faculty and it wasn't 1%. Later, when asked if UA employees with salaries over $250,000 had received raises without promotions, UA spokesperson Mitch Zack said they were not eligible for an increase through the salary increase program, but didn't say if there were any raises given outside of it. Compensation adjustments for employees that at that level prior to the SIP or salary increase program reflect their individual professional qualifications, performance, and job responsibilities benchmarked to market rates, Zach said. Hudson said, based on the little information she has about the total pools of faculty and staff raises available for allotment, she's quite sure that the amount to be distributed is nowhere near what people need to make up for the inflation and cost of living changes over the past year. And this is part of a long trend of not keeping up with the cost of living and inflation and being exempt from the kind of cost of living mechanisms that other state employees are afforded, Hudson said. And then I would go on to say that, in fact, we don't have a full overview of the salary increase program, she continued. With the raises due to roll out with the first October paycheck, we don't know who's getting a raise. We don't know the methodologies designed by the different colleges and approved by the provost's office to decide who gets what kind of small or merit-based or perhaps larger merit-based raises in the colleges. We simply don't know. Mitchell added that nearly all faculty and staff members he's spoken with think a 1% across-the-board raise is woefully insufficient given the additional workload due to the UA's financial crisis, which was revealed in the fall of 2023, and the debt issue created by Robbins and the former CFO, Lisa Rolney. 1% is well below the rate of inflation since the COVID-19 pandemic, he added. Many employees wonder why the current administration chose to prioritize reducing the budget deficit to zero in just 20 months instead of prioritizing providing just compensation to the university's employees, Mitchell said. The current administration could just as easily have decided to reduce the budget deficit over a 3 to 4 year period and provided funds freed up by the slightly longer repayment period so as to provide meaningful salary increase to those who educate and serve our students, she said. What good is being debt-free on a house if, in the meantime, you've let the foundation crumble and the roof collapse? Due to time constraints, we have reached the end of today's reading of the Arizona Daily Star, the September 15th, 2025 edition. For Sun Sounds of Arizona, this is Michael Shannon, your volunteer reader. Thank you very much for listening.